Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government joins us with the latest from the legislature. The tax cap override was approved, and some free fees are increasing for some solid waste services. We'll learn more. The New York Public News Network's Capitol reporters wrap up this week's New York primary and tell us what to expect as we head to the general election in November. Plus, what does the science really say about cannabis? We hear from Ganja Granny as researchers and a Harvard physician separate the evidence from the hype. And an art exhibit in Narrowsburg is turning the idea of old masters on its head. We'll hear how two artists are reclaiming a familiar title. That's next, after the news, from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The acting president of Venezuela says the death toll after two powerful earthquakes this week has risen to at least 589. Nearly 3,000 others were injured. 2 days after the quakes, emergency crews continue to dig through the rubble and debris of collapsed buildings in the capital. Cesar Jimenez is with Project Hope. He's in Caracas, where rescue teams are racing to find survivors.
Maybe more than 40 or 50 buildings partially or totally collapsed. I'm talking about businesses, households, hotels, maybe 15 or to 20 stories building totally collapsed with a lot of people inside, a lot of pets, kids. It's really heartbreaking, and there are still hundreds of people trapped under the buildings.
The Trump administration has pledged $150 million in humanitarian aid. Stocks on Wall Street opened lower this morning as oil prices fell. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 108 points in early trading.
As oil tanker traffic in the Strait of Hormuz begins to come untangled, Saudi Arabia is preparing to start shipping oil once again. Saudi Aramco began loading tankers at its Ras Tanura terminal for the first time in almost 4 months. Crude oil prices have fallen nearly 10% in the last week, with the U.S. benchmark dropping below $70 a barrel. Retail gas and diesel prices have also been inching lower, although AAA says the average price of regular gas is still about 92 cents a gallon higher than when the war with Iran began. Apple is raising prices for MacBooks and iPads, and the price of iPhones is expected to jump as well. The company blames the rising cost of memory chips, sparked by the artificial intelligence boom. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration says it's teaming up with a Texas-based private company to preserve the DNA of endangered species. NPR's Nate Rott reports.
The company, Colossal Biosciences, is best known for its efforts to bring back extinct species like the woolly mammoth and the direwolf, efforts that have raised a lot of concerns in the broader wildlife conservation community. Under the new partnership, the company says it will aim to store DNA, tissue, or cell samples of the more than 2,300 plants and animals protected under the Endangered Species Act, and that it will use them for research. Zoos, academic institutions, and federal agencies already biobank samples of imperiled species, which can be used to help their recovery. Some scientists are critical, though, of the government partnering with a for-profit company to help those efforts. Nate Rott, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street are trading lower at this hour. The Dow was down 75 points, the Nasdaq down 124. This is NPR News in Washington. Apple is raising prices amid a shortage of computer memory chips. NPR's John Ruwitch reports.
Apple quietly boosted prices on its website for a range of products, including MacBooks and iPads. In many cases, prices went up around 15 to 20%. So, for instance, a 14-inch MacBook Pro that cost $1,699 yesterday, according to archived web pages, now starts at $1,999. Apple TV 4K is now $199 instead of $129. For Apple's most popular product, the iPhone, it kept prices flat. The rapid expansion of AI data centers has created a surge in demand for memory and storage, leading to a spike in chip prices. Apple says that's created an unprecedented challenge for the entire consumer electronics industry. Apple says it shielded customers for a while, but the cost of memory chips has reached a point where it needs to start raising prices. Several other major players have already done so. John Ruich, NPR News.
Apple is a financial supporter of NPR. A massive heat wave continues to grip much of Western Europe. Temperatures have topped 104 degrees in parts of France, Italy, Spain, and the UK. Dennis Sengel owns a dry cleaning shop in South London.
We have to finish the job. It doesn't matter how hot, because the people waiting there, garments and other things, and basically we have a responsible, we have to finish on time.
Researchers say extreme heat like this is now about 200 times more likely than it was 20 years ago because of climate change. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia. For 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And it's Friday, so we're joined by Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, as we are most Fridays. Hello, sir.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Happy Friday.
To you as well.
And we've got some news from the legislature. Something we talked about before, the tax cap override, that was something that was being considered by the legislature that has been approved.
The ability to do the tax cap override. Yeah. That doesn't mean that it's going to happen this December when they approve the budget and whatever related property tax increase will come with it. And I'm sorry to say, but there will be an increase. But the state years ago, I think under Governor Cuomo, set up a 2% or thereabouts. It depends on a number of different factors, but it's usually between 1.7 and 3.5% usually is what I've seen before. But for these purposes, a 2% property tax cap increase. And if a governing body, in this case the county legislature, wishes to exceed that or thinks that they might be exceeding that when it comes time to adopt a budget, they need to, ahead of time, have a public hearing and then have a vote to give themselves the ability to do that. That was held last Thursday. Trying to remember my days here, yes. And it was approved, and legislators, well, county officials first, are doing everything they can to avoid that. But legislators are the ultimate decision makers on that, and they gave themselves that, I guess you'd call it wiggle room, which who's going to be happy about that? But it is probably going to be a necessity.
And let's remind folks why they think they might need that wiggle room.
Because of you, Tim. No.
All my fault.
Yeah,
I get that a lot.
Yeah, no, if it were easy enough to blame on one person or
yes,
one situation,
it would be
so much easier. But it is not, just so everyone out there realizes, it is not Tim's fault. It's nothing to do with that. We have had a precipitous decline in sales tax revenue in Sullivan County. We are down around $13, $14 million this year versus this time last year. And that trend seems to be continuing. We also are seeing some revenue declines in other areas. We're hoping the summer will actually at least steady that, if not see a bump in those revenues come in. We are working hard on increasing our other revenue areas. I'll be talking about our solid waste fees going up, but also we're trying to market the airport, for example, get people in there who are going to build hangars, rent office space, use the airport more than it is now, and all these ways to try to not increase the burden on property taxpayers. There for a few years, we were in that wonderful position where sales tax revenue actually exceeded property tax revenues for the county, which allowed us to keep tax increases relatively low. But I'm afraid that probably will not be the case this year, although we still have half the year to go. So we'll see as we go along here. But it's looking a little grim.
Where are some of those other deficiencies in other revenue streams you just mentioned?
Well, in addition to the sales tax, I think room tax had gone down, although hopefully that's coming back up. We are seeing that mortgage tax actually has increased quite a bit. So that's a good sign that people are buying houses in the area. The gaming revenue has declined somewhat. We're a little concerned about with Resorts World having opened their new facility in Queens, is it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I keep thinking it's Brooklyn, but it's Queens. That is yet to be understood how much of an impact that's going to be. But listen, to put it bluntly, my boss, Josh Potosik, the county manager, told another member of the media not too long ago on the record that he said, if we kept everything status quo and didn't find places to reduce our expenses, we would be looking at north of a 30 to 35% tax increase. That just is... I mean, who wants to even think about such a thing? Obviously, Josh has to, along with our Office of Management and Budget. So he has put out a directive to all our commissioners, our department heads, our directors, including yours truly, to cut expenses by at least 10%, and if not more than that, for 2027. Across our different departments and divisions. Of course, this has to be done with very careful precision because contrary to popular opinion or the prevailing view, government is not profligately spending, well, that's a big word to use on the radio, all over the place. The things that we have discretion over to cut are the things that people really depend upon. You know, we're not mandated, for example, to provide road patrol or sanitation services or the Move Sullivan public transportation. But how many of our people in our communities do depend upon those and don't want to see those disappear? So it can't, just like we can't spend crazily, we can't just cut crazily either. We have to be very studious and diligent about it. And there's going to be a lot of talk in the county manager's office and in department offices over the next few months before the budget even makes its way out to legislators to review. And then I'm sure they are going to have things to look at, talk about, review before they make the final decision. Probably, I think they have to make it by December 20th. So sometime mid-December as to what the budget and the tax impact ultimately will be for 2027.
The 10% reduction that you're being tasked with finding and all of county government's being tasked with finding, is that recent? Was this just decided?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and he put that out about 2-3 weeks ago because this is the time now to be planning for next year's budget. It's always the time that these kinds of memos go out. And Josh has made it very clear to the folks in our offices that we are in a very difficult time. And we need to make sure that we are justifying every single dollar that we spend. Not that we don't already, but like really justifying it. Like this is absolutely critical service.
Are there services for county residents that may be impacted this year?
Not that I'm aware of. I asked about that myself just the other day, and it doesn't seem to be. So
you're projecting for next year the tax cap override. Approve the ability to increase that. No idea of what that might look like yet, right? Because
you're
still calculating and projecting.
We all wish we did know that now, but that's not how it works. We're still waiting to see what kind of revenues come in as the year progresses. And also, of course, the offices have to present their budget requests to the county manager and the Office of Management and Budget. Even then, I've seen it before, there's cutting that can go on then at that point, too, where people say, this is what I'm going to give you. And then Josh and company say, well, this is what we can afford. And that happens every year just as a routine matter. But this year it will have, a particular urgency with it. But what I would like folks to remember is the vast majority of the people in county government are Sullivan County taxpayers and residents who understand how important these services are, but also understand how in New York State taxpayers are already overburdened by quite a bit. So this is being handled with the utmost seriousness of intent and care, and whatever is decided upon by legislators in the end will have been arrived at through not just days or weeks, but months of preparation and deep dives into what can the county afford to do and what can't it afford to do?
But bottom line, next year, Sullivan County residents can expect some form of a tax increase.
Yeah, as I said, we've got the 2% property tax cap on the one end, and we've got the over 30% property tax increase if we didn't change anything from 2026 to 27 on the other end. So we've got to find something in the middle there. And of course, everyone's working to try to get it down to as close to that 2% tax cap as possible. But I do anticipate there will be a tax increase of some sort.
One of the ways you're looking to raise revenue is to increase some fees for solid waste services.
Mm-hmm.
And what are those services and how much are they going up?
Well, currently, for municipal solid waste, and this is for bulk disposal, it's charging $137 a ton or $60 per cubic yard. As of October 1st, that's going to go up, and this was just approved by the legislature, to $160 a ton or $80 per cubic yard. That's for municipal solid waste. Also for construction and demolition debris, that was at $135 or currently is at $135 a ton or $60 per cubic yard. That's going to go up in October to $160 a ton and $80 per cubic yard. Also have increased the fee for accepting tires with or without rims. For four tires or less, if their 19-inch rims are smaller, that's still going to stay $3 per tire. I misspoke. That's going to be going from $3 per tire to $5 per tire. The over 19-inch rim tires are going to stay at $30 per tire. And then also CFC-containing appliances. These are things like refrigerators or air conditioners. The current fee to take those are $15. That's going to go up to $20. Most other fees are staying the same. Recycling remains free. Household bagged garbage, that's not changing. That's $15 for a 5-coupon book or $30 for a 10-coupon book. 1-pound propane tanks will still take off your hands at no cost. 20-pound tanks, $2. So not everything is increasing, but strategically there are areas where it is. And there are also, the legislature is going to be setting a public hearing about our flow control law, which mandates that any garbage generated in Sullivan County has to be disposed of in Sullivan County. It's a hard thing to enforce. I get it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we have officers stationed at our borders checking people who are taking garbage out of the county. And that's not what it's going to become. So, but there will be a public hearing. And we'll have more about the law. They haven't finalized the draft yet, so I don't have that to share, but it'll be on the website. And I'll be here talking about it more before we get to the public hearing, which is set for July 23rd at 8:45 a.m., just before other legislative meetings.
Let's take a break, and we'll be back with more from Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, is it possible that the American Revolution wasn't really all that?
It seemed to be a parade of quite boring men talking very earnestly about liberty, battles that involve 20 people in a field somewhere in the great vastness of North American continent.
I'll talk with the host of the podcast, The Rest is History, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Jose Andres, a Spanish chef with 2 Michelin stars and 40 restaurants worldwide. As the founder of World Central Kitchen, Andres has fed tens of millions of people across dozens of crises. And he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and I'm joined in the studio by Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. A story that we saw earlier this week, we spoke to Assemblywoman Paula Kay about some workforce housing that's coming to the Monticello Raceway. So a bright spot in the affordable housing crisis that seems to be everywhere. But here it looks like there's 100 units that are coming.
Yes. And it's with the same developer that the county is working with, Kenneth Kearney or Carney, I'm not exactly sure how you say his last name, who is looking to do about the same, maybe a little bit more, maybe around 120 units next door to the care center in Liberty of workforce housing. A lot of people think, oh, government can sort of wave a magic wand and create housing. But unless government wants to be in the landlord business, which is a very expensive and challenging proposition because you have to hire staff for that, you really are dependent upon these housing developers to come and create this kind of housing. And thankfully, we feel like we found a good partner in Ken or Kenneth. And it looks like Assemblymember Kay feels the same way. I was just delighted to see that this was coming to Monticello, because Monticello and Liberty are two population centers. They need this workforce housing more than probably any other location in Sullivan County. And we'll encourage people to come live here and work here. We still are, even with our financial difficulties, and still the county as a whole, not just county government, but the private industry as well, we continue to lead the state in job growth. We are always in the top five every month that I see for almost the past 5 years for job growth. We have more jobs than we have people to fill them. And a real key part of it is that we don't have enough housing for people to stay and to work these jobs. And where are they going to live? Well, you're either going to live out in the boonies and have a very long commute, or you're going to live in some place like Middletown or over in the Ulster County area, where jobs are more plentiful. And as soon as you find something maybe closer to you there, you're going to do that. So part of the economic development strategy for the county includes, in fact, it's right at the top of it, creating housing, workforce housing that the government isn't running. We can help maybe subsidize or support. We're applying for, I think it's $1 million grant that would go towards the infrastructure necessary to be extended to the Liberty housing. But then the developer himself gets to manage or create, bring in a management company, make some profit off of it. There's nothing wrong with that. But still have rents be affordable for people in the community, because as we all know, the cost of housing has shot up and the availability of it has bottomed out. So we need to be able to provide housing that not only is affordable, but also available to people. So
one of the things we talked about a little earlier about solid waste and recycling, we've got a food scrap recycling program and composting program that's free, actually, for folks. Where is that?
I feel like I haven't had a chance to talk to you about this in a long
time.
This isn't the pilot. Well, this, remember the pilot project
where we had the food scrap,
and that got off the ground.
Yes.
And we are working right now to get a composting facility built over at Monticello. We're waiting for DEC permission on that. We're going through the process. It'll probably be another couple of years. But right now, as a sort of an offshoot of that, we are working with the Sullivan Fresh Farmers Market in Monticello. Every Thursday, they're there, and between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m., from now through, I think, September 24th is their last day, food scrap drop-off is free. So you can come to the farmers market with your old garbage food, the stuff you want
potato
to throw away,
peelings,
and replace it right there with new fresh food that you can pick up right at the farmers market. So all food is accepted. Of course, you got to remove things like stickers, bands, ties, but we will take bones and shells as well. Leftover or spoiled food, coffee grounds, paper filters. The only thing we won't take are compostable bags or packaging like plates, cups, takeout containers, and of course non-compostable stuff like plastic bags, packaging, stickers. I mean, you can bring that, but you're going to have to dump the food out of that into a container. You can't just drop a plastic bag into that. So, and also, if it's organic, things like pet waste or spent flowers, soiled paper, we're not accepting that either. It has to be food.
And where does this go once it's dropped off?
It is brought to a commercial composting facility where it is turned into compost. I believe we take it over to Ulster County. And of course, this is part of what we already do at our transfer stations. But I assume our recycling coordinator, Cassie Thelman, and the Sullivan Fresh Farmers Market people over at Cordell Cooperative Extension thought, hey, this is a great idea. It's sort of just a no-brainer, as they say. It's like, bring your food that you're replacing, dump it here at the farmer's market, and then pick up fresh new food. And it's a win-win for everybody.
gets recycled.
Yes.
Let's remind folks of some upcoming meetings. And the Charter Review Commission meeting is set for this Wednesday at 4. Remind folks again, the charter is reviewed regularly. And
right.
This is another.
The charter of the county is like the Constitution of the United States, just maybe not quite as important, but it's important for us locally. It is the document that was created when the legislature came into being a little over 30 years ago. And as part of that creation, it was a charter review commission that was made that was determined that the charter needs to be reviewed every 10 years. So we are at that 10-year point, and in fact, we're a little bit past it. We have a charter review commission that has been engaged. I believe it has 8 or 9 members on it. I think there might be one being replaced at some point. They had to resign. But they meet the first Wednesday of every month at 4 o'clock in the hearing room of the government center. The meetings are open to the public, although you don't really have to go to know what's happened there because they're recorded. And we have a Charter Review Commission page on the county website at sullivanny.gov where you can go and see the agendas, read the minutes, and also listen to the audio of the actual event. There's no video. It's just audio at this point. Usually the meetings last between 1 and 2 hours because, of course, they have a lot to go through. It's going to take them probably a couple of years to interview all sorts of different county employees, state officials, and then figure out, is there anything that needs to be changed in the charter? Is there a better way of doing things that we can recommend to the legislature? They only make recommendations. The legislature actually makes the final decision on whether or not to follow through with these recommendations, but it is a function of the charter to be reviewed every 10 years, and that is what is happening as we speak.
And there's a notary public test set for August 12th coming
yes. up. These things are insanely popular. I guess there are a lot of people who need and want to become notaries.
Yeah, you're always kind of looking for who's a notary? I always ask this, but now I know. I have a go-to.
They're popular. It's a paid thing you can charge fees for, but the state is very specific about the regulations and the training. And so Sullivan County Clerk Russell Reeves and his office, in conjunction with the State Division of Licensing Services, is offering what's called the Notary Public Test. It's going to be August 12th, 2026 at the Government Center. Seating is limited. I may even be too late on it now, but listen, folks, if you're interested, get in touch with the clerk's office right away. 845-807-0429. That's 807-0429. Or email your name and phone number to notaryexam@sullivanny.gov. That will register you if we still have seats available. Walk-ins can't be accommodated. There is a $15 fee for the examination. And of course, don't do what I know some people have done where you don't actually study for it and you take the exam, you don't pass, and you got to do it all over again. I know people who have done that. I'm not going to name names, but trust me, just like with any test, just give it a little study time ahead of time.
I would think.
I know $15 doesn't feel like, you know, the $1,000 per credit you might pay at college, but
I wouldn't know the first thing about being a notary, so I would think I'd have to look it up.
Yes, and some people do a very passing job of studying, and they don't pass the actual test. Coming up on August 12th, now is the time to register if you're interested.
Primary was on Tuesday. From the County Board of Elections perspective, a successful day for folks?
Yes. Our Board of Elections works very hard for many months just on the primary. We still have a general election coming up, which they've turned their attention to because it was naturally taken away a little bit by the fact that we had a primary. And we had 10 days of early voting plus primary day across the county. So it was a Herculean effort. And we actually had, I think, around 2,000 plus voters turn out, registered Democrats and Republicans, which I think was actually a fairly good turnout. Not naturally, we have many more registered voters than that in the county, but
it's a primary.
Yeah. And it's important for our Board of Elections folks and their election inspectors to see the public coming out to this and participating in this, because you know how you feel if you do something that takes a Herculean amount of effort and then nobody shows up or you have a really low turnout. I mean, yeah, sure, it's required by law that they do this, but it means something to them as well. And I certainly, to me, somebody who believes in the Republican democratic form of government that we have, I'm not talking about political parties. I'm talking about where some people say we're a democracy, some people say we're a republic. So that's why I'm putting those together, just to say it's important for the people to be involved in their government. It's part of my job why it even exists. But it's even more so why their jobs exist in the Board of Elections, is to have people turn out.
Well, I was number 61, I think, at the Delaware Youth Center, my polling place, after work. It seemed kind of a light number. A primary, and there wasn't a lot to vote on, for at least my side of things, to vote on. But this next election, this general election, much more important at the local level. Let's remind folks again that these local positions that you voted for last November are all going to be up again for re-election because of a change in the New York State even-numbered voting years law. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, we all get so excited about the presidential election, and that brings out the passion and the activity and stuff. But in some respects, that affects us less than the local elections. And yet, counterintuitively, we have more voter turnout in the presidential election years. And I'm not dismissing that. Trust me, I know what is happening at the federal level. But the fact is that we have local folks who you probably know or going to have to know or deal with, who are making decisions that impact your life sometimes on a daily basis. You need to know who these people are, what they plan to do, how they're asking for your vote, and then vote accordingly with that. And yes, as you said, the state now has said that it's even your voting for most local positions, not all, but most local positions. So people who were voted into office last year and you would assume would be in for at least two or more years are up for election again this year. So you actually have a unique opportunity to make a quicker decision on them than you would otherwise. Like, okay, you've had a year to do your work here. Do I want to keep you in office or do I want to go with your contender?
And this is across the state, so every county, most of these positions, we're talking like supervisors and clerks and all of these local level positions. I know there's a lot of attention on the midterms, and there should be a lot of attention on the very vital congressional races in New York State specifically toss the balance of power in Washington. But at the local level, again, all of these are going to be up for re-election in the fall.
I constantly tell people, again, it's why my job exists. Pay attention to your local governments. Pay attention to what they're doing. It will affect you more immediately and more profoundly than anything that happens at the federal level. I've seen it. I've been covering politics for 30 years now. I'm involved in government. It is an absolutely essential that we have an informed populace that, in my opinion, just as informed on what's going on locally as they are at the state or federal levels.
About 4 months to get educated on all that, folks.
Yep, you got the time. Do it.
All right. So. Let's also recognize some things that the legislature recognized. Disability Pride Month.
Yes. Disability Pride Month. This is different from Pride Month in June. This is is actually observed in July, and it's about being proud if you are differently abled, or as the old term is, disabled. And those of us who may not be as much, I think, although I'd say some of us all in one way or another deal with disabilities in our lives, maybe just not as visible, but to be proud of the folks who are courageous, tenacious. I don't know what other shush I can use it all of that, but you know what I mean. You know, I have some family members myself who deal with very significant physical infirmities and disabilities, and yet are inspiring people. And that's what the legislature wanted to recognize at its meeting last Thursday. Even though it's not yet July, they wanted to get a head start because we're not meeting again due to the July 4th holiday. Legislature doesn't start meeting again until the second week of July. So legislator Kat Scott, who was the real originator of this, wanted to make sure Lee Karasik, too, was part of it, that we gave that shout out to folks. It is not LGBTQIA++ focused. Obviously, that's all inclusive in that. But this Pride is a different from, like I said, the Pride in June. We are currently flying that Pride flag, though, in front of the government center until the end of June. And then that will be replaced by the Disability Pride flag for all of July.
Juneteenth celebrated by the legislature and courts as well.
Yes. Friday. This was on Friday, but most of the legislature turned out for this as well. It filled up the hearing room with people who were there to celebrate the retired longtime Monticello postmaster, Deborah Mack, who was the first black female postmaster throughout many Hudson Valley post offices. And I think to this day is still one that's reached that highest level in that many post offices in the area. I think she even did it down in the Maryland, D.C. area. She's a Monticello native and current resident. And then also Judge William Little, he's a New York State Supreme Court justice, just got elected to that not too long ago. He is originally from Monticello, now lives up in Albany for obvious reasons. But he was lauded by the legislature and also the New York State Office of Court Administration, I think, that was put together by Judge Danielle Joes Decker, who is one of our local judges, and she's also the administrative law judge for the 3rd Judicial District. So it was the most packed room I had ever seen. It is on video. You can see it. We recorded it. It was a very moving and inspiring event and something that really, I think, spoke to the minority community in the county that, you know, your voice, your accomplishments matter. They are part of what this county is built upon, needs to celebrate, wants to celebrate.
And before we go, you want to shout out congrats to the local graduates.
Just wanted to say congratulations. I will be at Sullivan West graduation. I think so. Yeah. Yes. I know tonight is, for example, Sullivan West High School's graduation. I will be there for that to cheer on some graduates that we know. But also this whole weekend, all the different school districts in Sullivan County will be having their graduation ceremonies, and then there will be graduation parties. And it is just a very life-affirming, wonderful time of year here in the county. Congratulations to all those grads who have worked so hard for this moment. And we can't wait to see what happens next. It may be a little intimidating, but there are good things ahead.
And July 4th is on a Saturday this year. That means county government offices will be observing the holiday and be closed on Friday the 3rd.
Friday the 3rd. And there is no legislature on Thursday the 2nd. Typically, the first Thursday of the month, there would be legislative meetings. But there are so many July 4th plans going on. Legislators decided we're going to move it to July 9th instead. So we will be open on Thursday the 2nd, but there won't be any legislative meetings. We will be closed, though, all offices on Friday the 3rd.
Get your July 4th plans lined up?
I do, actually, yes. And they involve probably more eating than I should.
Dan Hoost, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
It's good to see you again.
Next, we'll get some more analysis on the New York primary from the New York Public News Network. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor, offering exhibitions, performances, screenings, and more, with long-term installations from James Turrell and Saul LeWitt. Open year-round. CatskillArtSpace.org.
This week on CatsCast, it's peak hiking season in the Catskills, and hiking guide and mountain historian Paul Misko has the gear list and practical advice to help keep you on the trail and out of trouble.
I met one fellow, he didn't want to carry anything, and his reasoning was, nothing's ever happened to me. And I hope you can see the lack of logic in that response.
Saturday at 11 a.m., right here on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill. Primary voters have spoken, while Comptroller Tom DiNapoli won easily. It wasn't a great night for other incumbents around New York State. The New York Public News Network reporters Jimmy Vielkind and Samuel King break down the results.
Hi, Samuel.
Hi, Jimmy.
Before we get to the election, I want to talk about immigration quickly. The Supreme Court ruled that immigrants from Haiti and Syria who had temporary protective status can be deported. Democratic officials say that could hurt the economy, as many of these immigrants are authorized to work in New York. But there was also a new lawsuit filed over New York's new immigration law. What's in the challenge?
The Justice Department says Albany lawmakers overstepped with the new immigration protections enacted last month. Two big provisions are at issue. The first restricts when law enforcement officers, including ICE agents, can wear face masks while on duty. The second prohibits formal cooperation agreements between ICE and law enforcement in the state.
What's their argument?
Well, federal officials point to the part of the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause, which basically says that state law can't trump federal law. Here's John Sarcone, a Trump-appointed prosecutor in Albany.
There's the state, and there's a federal system. Federal law enforcement has a right and duty to do their job.
What do Democratic state officials say?
Well, Governor Hochul and Attorney General Letitia James held an event to say they want the law to go into effect. Hochul says those cooperation agreements should be struck down.
The agreements also say that they must follow state law. That is where we are able to step in and say our state law now prohibits them. That is why we'll be successful in court.
Well, that's certainly something we'll be keeping an eye on.
Yep. But let's talk about these election results. Some of the highest profile races were on the Democratic side and in New York City. What happened?
Well, three progressive challengers backed by Mayor Zoran Mamdani won seats in Congress. Two of those victorious candidates are members of the Democratic Socialists of America, and two of the people who lost were incumbents. I spoke with Fordham political science professor Christina Greer about her takeaways.
The Democratic Party needs to take notice on what they're doing in Washington, D.C. and in Albany, and making it clear to their voters that they're still relevant and working for them and not just becoming, you know, watered down Republicans from the past.
Now, the DSA is very bullish. Leaders are already talking about picking new targets for 2028.
And Jimmy, let's not forget about some other upstate wins for the DSA. Adam Bojack won a state assembly primary with the support of DSA out in western New York. Another DSA-backed candidate, Mo Brown, is neck and neck with longtime assembly member Bill Magnarelli in Syracuse.
I really wonder, though, if those kinds of results will scale outside of urban areas. You know, for example, Comptroller Tom DiNapoli easily won a statewide race against two progressive challengers, Drew Warshaw and Raj Goyal.
Very interesting.
And in the lower Hudson Valley, two moderate Democrats took around 80% of the vote in a primary over who would get to challenge Republican Congressmember Mike Mahler. The progressive candidates got buried. Kate Connolly won.
On the Republican side, we were watching the 21st District. There was a nasty Republican primary between Anthony Constantino and Assemblymember Robert Smullen. Constantino is an outsider, first-time candidate, and he really ran hard on the endorsement he got from President Trump. Smullen is a Marine veteran and legislator. He had support from state and local Republicans in the North Country District. Constantino won big. It's a sign that in Republican circles, Trump's endorsement is still as good as gold. Political consultant Bradley Honan explained that even though New York is a blue state, that megaphone could have an impact in the general election as well.
He is, for better or worse, able to direct endorsements to electoral outcomes.
We'll have to see how things play out.
Talk soon, Jimmy.
Jimmy Vielkind and Samuel King from the New York Public News Network Capital Bureau. Still to come, what cannabis has actually been proven to help and where the science is still catching up. That's ahead. We'll hear from the Ganja Granny. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Science Friday, surprising success with a new drug to treat pancreatic cancer.
We've never had a moment quite like this. So in my opinion, it is a breakthrough moment in the history of pancreatic cancer.
Plus, looking into flow state with the bassist from Phish. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Today, 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Cannabis is legal for adult recreational use in both New York and neighboring New Jersey, but questions remain about what the science actually says it can and can't do for people's health. Ganja Granny is the podcast that explores cannabis through the lens of science, policy, culture, and personal experience, hosted by longtime journalist Karen Michelle. In episode 3, Karen Michelle separates the evidence from hype, exploring what researchers have found about cannabis as a treatment for pain, sleep, anxiety, and other conditions.
The episode features scientists and a Harvard physician discovering where the research is strong, where it's still evolving, and why good information matters for both experienced users and the cannabis curious. Here's an excerpt from episode 3 of the Ganja Granny podcast.
To prepare for this, I read hundreds of pages of serious books, scientific studies, opinion pieces, consumed hours of assorted media, some of what was essentially propaganda for one point of view or another, and came up with a quandary as to how to distill it, make it useful. As Harvard and Massachusetts General Hospital's Dr. Peter Grinspoon observes,
I think we need to sort of expand our paradigm a little bit. We haven't outgrown the Puritanism and also like the long shadow of the war on drugs. You know, there's sort of a puritanical feeling that like, if you can enjoy it, it's not a medicine.
That proved to be inherent in the way much of the research is framed. I needed to start making sense of the overall not so many years of research into the effects and potential medical applications of a weed on older folks, which brought me to Dr. Peter Grinspoon, author most recently of Aging Well with Cannabis. Cannabis is a very old story.
It's been used for 5,000 years for medical purposes, mostly to alleviate symptoms.
Peter was receptive to my musings.
It helps people with creativity, with focus, with mindfulness. People find that they appreciate art, music, sex, nature more fully. And as we medicalize and pathologize, or have pathologized cannabis use and criminalized it, what's fallen out of attention is the fact in which people have also used it for many thousands of years as a lifestyle enhancer. And, you know, it could be a fine line between enhancing your lifestyle and alleviating medical symptoms, because if you're enjoying art, you're not focusing on your chronic pain. So I think I agree with you that in many ways, they're two sides of the same coin, but there is a subtle difference in emphasis. And certainly under the war on drugs, with all the nonsense about cannabis.
That's anecdotal and valid in its own way, but scientific proof is another matter. And getting that proof can be especially daunting. The University of Iowa's Dr. Brian Caskey has been researching cannabis for a decade or so. Much of what we actually know in this country has come from his and his colleagues' work.
One reason why there is some reluctance out there about identifying cannabis as a legitimate therapeutic alternative is that many of us are trained as scientists, and we learn about the scientific method when we go through undergraduate and graduate programs. We base what we do on, you know, a pile of evidence, something that's been tested and shown repeatedly to work over and over. And until that happens, you know, until we have that basic mechanism between, in this case, the phytocannabinoids and the receptors in the human bodies, and we can predict what happens and what occurs when this happens, there's going to be a lot of reluctance to endorse cannabis as a medical or therapeutic product. Remember, you know, a lot of us hold the line here because, you know, 100 years ago, before we had all this in place, you had a lot of people out there selling snake oil and passing off, you know, remedies that didn't work. And by upholding the scientific method and looking for a sufficient amount of evidence, I think we're doing the public a service here.
And providing that service is a slow haul. There are the random controlled studies, usually at first in lab cultures or rodents, and then the subjects are humans. When the subject is the much maligned marijuana, there are many hurdles, even for the best academic athletes.
It's challenging because on one hand, we have to comply with the federal requirements, and therefore, if we are to, you know, test any cannabis-related products, we have to submit those products to a review. And, you know, that product then gets, you know, determined whether it's, you know, considered to be an investigational new drug. It's something we can look into. Then we have to move into our state environment. And now each state has created, if you will, a regulatory framework for what can and can't be provided.
And then here at the university, at the research level, there's a third level of review and oversight. It's challenging.
Some states have proven more open.
For example, our first studies were funded by the state of Colorado. The state of Colorado, when they established their program 10 years ago or so, said, we're going to take a certain amount of the revenue from the program and we're going to plow it back into research. And because we don't really know what we got here. And so the state of Colorado has been funding investigators for 10 years now to find out more about what's going on with cannabis. And we are fortunate enough to get awarded by them very early on because we were the only ones talking about older persons. And so that happened to us in a few states, state of Illinois, state of Colorado said, wow, nobody's talking to us about older persons. And yet they're probably our largest age group of users we don't know anything about. So that's kind of how my research got funded.
You can listen to the full episode and past episodes of Ganja Granny at our website, wjffradio.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, an upcoming exhibit at Chester's Creative in Berryville is challenging who gets remembered as an old master. Opening this weekend, the show pairs the work of Monticello artist Malik Titus Bridges with longtime artist Catherine Chester's. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi has more.
I'm just going to throw out there, what's the name about old masters?
It's really like a play on, you know, the classical old masters, how back then it was only a certain type of person, per se, you know, that was seen as shown in the art world. And we're kind of claiming that we're now the old masters, and here we are. That's it in a nutshell, but Kathy, you want to get more detail?
Yeah, when I looked at Malik's work, and I was looking at his portraits that he's done, there was this one specific series that's going to be in the show that were all in this beautiful muted palette, and they immediately reminded me of portraits of old masters like Van Gogh. And it got me thinking about the juxtaposition of then and now, and really the voice of that time, you know, the painters of that time, I should say, not the voice, were all white men, basically. And anyone of color, women, there was just no representation from that times. And there was something speaking to me. I was stimulated, immediately inspired by the pictures, the paintings, when I saw the paintings. But then I started thinking about, you know, what is this? And I always try to represent abstract artists at the galleries, specifically abstract or intuitive painters. But also I just want to, you know, make sure that a voice is heard throughout the community as well. So I was kind of playing with both those concepts when we came up with the name Old Masters, and we were riffing on it and talking about it and decided that that would be a good name. And really it is just about the contrast of what an old master is. It's not that we are old masters, but we are a voice that isn't always represented. That was the crux of it.
Malik, when did you begin to engage with your artistic abilities?
Man, for as long as I can remember, just drawing the same picture on the beach in like kindergarten with the sun in the corner, and for some reason there was corn on the beach. I would always go back to that, but it took a really awesome high school teacher, Jay Brooks, shout out to him, to show me the power of painting, per se. No matter what we were doing in class, he knew that I loved to paint, so he just allowed me to, like, go in a corner and go paint. But it wasn't until after I left college, you know, all my friends were going on and doing all these cool things, and I just kind of went back to my foundation in 2015 when I came home, and ever since then, I've just been painting. And
now, you mentioned the beach. Did you go up near the beach?
No, I'm not sure where that beach image came from. My family didn't go to the beach too often, but I, you know, as an adult, I love the beach. So maybe it was something subconscious in there, deep, that was trying to communicate with me.
And did you go to school here in Monticello?
Yes, I went to high school in Monticello. Then went to SUNY Delhi to study architecture.
And you are also part of the Black Library.
Yes.
What's your involvement there?
Spiritual guide.
Meaning?
advisor.
To the other artists and people involved?
Yeah, and to myself, artist in residence.
How long have you been an artist in residence?
I was there for the 2 years.
And I see you also co-teach with Catherine at Bethel Woods.
Yes.
What do you teach there?
In a nutshell, I teach 7 to 8 adults in 3 different programs. There's like the adult winter program I do every so often. And there's the fine arts that are 10, 14-year-olds, middle school. And then I also do the play all day, which is 7 to 9. So mixed bag.
The academy.
It's called the Academy. It's a high school. It's an after-school program for high schools. Monticello, Felton West, Fallsburg, and Liberty. Totally forgot about that, too. So yeah.
It's called Bethel Academy, and this last year was its pilot year. And it's a new initiative that they've given us, that they've developed, sorry, not given us, but they've offered the opportunity for Malik and I to be teaching artists that work with a lead teacher who's there full time. And so it's in its first year, but it's an amazing program, and we're very lucky to be part of that.
Catherine, tell us about your engagement with the arts.
How long have you got?
Well, you know, we can just do a few highlights.
You know, I had a career as a graphic designer for 28 years in the city, and I... halfway through that, born out of frustration, I started to create paintings really as a release from the constraints and frustrations of graphic design, because it's still a creative medium, but it's got a lot of guardrails up around it and a lot of people's opinions. So I found this intuitive painting that I started around 2009, 2010, and it really was an amazing experience to see what was coming out of me. There was no plan, there was nothing. And that started the whole journey. And I was doing it really as just a thing on the side, but I got picked up, I'm blanking on the word. They represent artists in it with interiors, specific to present them to interior designers. And so they picked me up, and I don't know, that just things started to get traction. I started picking up shows. And then really when I moved up to this region full time, I really developed more focus and started having some solo shows. And then 2024, I got this studio, which gave me a great space to work and a gallery component so that I could start inviting other artists to showcase their work as well. So it's kind of just been this natural progression. Finding time to really push my own work is hard, and finding time to get residencies and push myself forward as an artist at this stage is a challenge because of the teaching and the studio and the gallery. But yeah, I love it, and I will continue.
I noticed you also run workshops there, collage workshops.
I do. Well, I've tried a few different workshops, but what I love is the collage workshop. It's there for the community. It is a donation-based evening. It's the first Wednesday of every month, so the date can change, but it's the first Wednesday of the month, and it's from 6 till 8. And you can arrive. You don't have to be an artist. You know, it's a community thing where I put on a playlist, I throw out a theme, I supply people with the elements, the scissors, the glue, the collage materials. You're welcome to bring any ephemera that you want. And we just sit and create, and it's beautiful, no pressure. It's really a great way to disengage your mind, not be on a screen, and there's no judgment, you know. It's really there for anyone to come and join. And you can sign up through my website. That is chesterscreative.com.
And that will have information about the upcoming exhibit, which opens on Saturday the 27th with a reception from 4 to 8. And the show is on through July 27th, correct?
Yeah. And there is the art events section, and there is the collage room, which is the collage night. So you can find all of that on the website.
And Malik, can we find information about you on online?
Instagram. So if you go to Instagram.com, SIFU9000.
All right. Well, thank you both for taking your time to share this information with our listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. And a reminder to come dance with us tomorrow night at the Coshecton Pump House. We've got tunes from Jason Tuga from the mixtape and Jeff Barnes of Electric Mountain. It's at the Coshecton Pump House tomorrow from 7 to 10. $10 suggested donation at the door. We all need to dance, right? We'll see you there. Thanks for listening. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. It's Radio Catskill. On Point is coming up next.